Have you wondered what happened after Ghostbusters? No, not Ghostbusters Afterlife. I don't even mean Ghostbusters 2. I mean what Ivan Reitman did after his biggest hit. This fall, the podcast Reitman for the Job is talking Legal Eagles, Twins, and the debut of a little show called The Real. Listen to Reitman for the Job.
And welcome to Filmstrips, the podcast that defies Steven Tyler. No, I will close my eyes. I want to miss a thing, and it's called this movie. I'm Dave Babbitt.
Well, somebody's got a lot of decidedly unsweet emotions. I'm Andrew Kanegeuser, and Dave, who are we and what are we doing with everybody's time this episode?
Why, this is Filmstrips, the podcast in which each and every week we take a look at a film, we look, throw it under the microscope, we look at the nuance, the subtext, the paratext, spoil the ever-loving hell out of it. The important thing is that each and every film we discuss has to connect back to the film we discussed upon the preceding episode. And Andrew, what were we taking a look at last time on this little program of ours?
Last time, we were joined by our good friend Eric Jones to dissect the grisly, multiply cloned corpse of the Aeon Flux live-action adaptation. A film that missed its mark, much as you would hope a large asteroid hurtling towards the Earth will, as long as it does by 0 hour. That film was produced by one Gail Ann Hurd, who we decided to follow to an equally spectacular filmic disaster, though maybe in a slightly different sense. We are going back to 1998, pre-Y2K, pre-9/11, pre-Transformers, where a simple auteur by the name of Michael Bay made a little film called Armageddon, featuring a script written by more people than you would think, editing by also more people than you would think, and a cast featuring far more people than you might remember, but most notably Bruce Willis, Ben Affleck, Liv Tyler, Billy Bob Thornton, Steve Buscemi, Owen Wilson, and Michael Clark Duncan, plus about 15 other people that we'll be getting into shortly. And I think, as Dave, you noted off the very top, the real takeaway for most people is Armageddon is the reason that you always hear that one Aerosmith song your mom totally loves anytime you're driving more than 3 hours with the radio on.
People loved this song? I know they did. I just refuse to accept that because that would fracture reality for me.
Well, yeah, but I mean, film exhibitors are certainly kind of going for broke these days, trying to get people back in theaters. And it worked. I mean, I went to the movies for the first time in almost 2 years the other week. And, like, one thing that has struck me as odd is there never used to be, like, special PSAs from Famous Players Canada being like, by the way, we're just really glad you're here. But we have talked about sort of industry pressures and things like that. You know, previously we've talked about the advent of television, sort of the breakup of the major Hollywood studios, the rise of the Hollywood Renaissance, and, you know, technological novelties like Cinerama. But I think one thing is clear, Dave, and that's when the industry is in trouble, sooner or later, it's going to stop running PSAs, and it's going to give us big screen, big budget, capital B blockbuster movies.
Indeed. And certainly, once upon a time, most of those were located to one spot in the year, and that was the summer film season. These days, who knows when they're coming out, because God knows everything's on the table now. But yeah, different time, different era in this instance. And they're, but generally speaking, if you wanted your prime blockbuster come out, May to the end of July was your big meal ticket. August, if you were kind of desperate, but usually those 3 months.
Well, it also speaks to, though, the idea that I mean, it's sort of old hat to say blockbuster films, they're pretty lousy, they're not really very good. And that kind of misses the point, because even lining it up for a certain release window speaks to what these films are really about, which is they are precision engineered to make a mass cultural popular impact. Much like an asteroid, I'm not going to keep going back to that. Because there's, you know, honestly, it's almost easy to take for granted. 1998, that was a long time ago. Michael Bay has gone on to bigger and arguably better things. Pretty much everybody in the cast did. And a little scribe by the name of J.J. Abrams certainly went onwards and upwards. Yeah. And I think there's a realistic chance that many of our listeners, if they're of a certain age, probably don't even remember this film. And so I think that's the opportune moment, Dave, for you to do what you do best and give us the rundown.
Armageddon is director Michael Bay's 1998 disaster film, starring Bruce Willis, Ben Affleck, and Liv Tyler. Written by a seeming platoon of notable screenwriters, the film is the story of an existence-ending asteroid heading towards Earth, which prompts the powers that be to recruit a team of deep-sea oil drillers to travel into space to place a nuclear device deep within the asteroid to prevent total annihilation of the human race. While a critical dud, Armageddon was the highest-grossing film worldwide in 1998, and infamously was included in the famed Criterion Collection shortly after its release. Coming up after film strips, Peter Boyle stars in an episode of the short-lived Death Wish, the series.
So, I mean, if you're trying to make a big-screen spectacle, you know, I think by design, you sort of have to go with either something that's so high-concept that it sells immediately, or something so universal in terms of a human value or a human fear that you more or less, like, you need that concept to begin with. And, I mean, granted, Armageddon, especially 1998, when there's a lot of anxiety about the coming millennium and sort of what form the end of the world is going to occur in, that's something that's definitely on everybody's mind, but they have maybe the simplest concept that you can come up with. A big chunk of rock that does not think and doesn't require dialogue is hurtling towards our chunk of rock, and if it hits, we're all dead. Regardless of what country you're in, regardless of what language you speak, that's an immediately understood threat and the perfect concept to hinge a film around. But despite the simplicity of that, though, reading more about Armageddon and in your, as is your wont, reading a lot more than I did, it turns out that the road to getting Armageddon on screen is a lot longer and a lot more convoluted than most people would probably expect.
Yeah, so, okay, we'll back up here and say one thing to note about the 90s was, while it would be hard to say that there was a disaster film renaissance, it was certainly closer to that than you would expect. Because for those who haven't seen disaster films like The Poseidon Adventure or Avalanche or one of the...
The Towering Inferno.
Exactly.
You know, sort of the basic setup is, well, you name your film after the disaster. Your plot is about 10 minutes on either side of the disaster beginning and ending. And it's also sort of like an excuse to trot out a large ensemble cast of maybe not A-listers, but at least a solid enough crew of familiar faces.
Well, exactly. I mean, sometimes you get Gene Hackman, other times you get Rock Hudson, and sometimes it's Michael Caine coming in after the disaster's done, and you get the Beyond the Poseidon Adventure. But we'll put that one aside for now, because we should visit that someday. Point is, in the 90s, you kind of have a little tiny bit of a revival of that in some different forms. I mean, certainly we end up getting things like in 1995, the summer of the dueling volcano movies there, in which case we ended up with not one, but two summer blockbusters about this. Dante's Peak, the one starring Pierce Brosnan and produced by Gail Ann Hurd. And then we got Volcano, the one with Tommy Lee Jones. I know which one I would prefer to sit there and watch.
I remember the guy melts into lava, and I'm pretty sure that's the first on-screen depiction I remember of a nicotine patch.
Okay, then. So, yeah, maybe they were groundbreaking in their way. But the point was, is, yeah, these, I mean, we also had that. We had the things like, oh, what was it? Was it Daybreak, the one with Sylvester Stallone where they're all trapped?
Yeah, where they're in the tunnel.
Yeah, which is much more fun than you would anticipate.
The first 10 minutes are exactly the same as What Dreams May Come. Yeah, Daybreak was another one. I don't know. Cliffhanger doesn't really count. That one's much more action oriented.
Yeah,
but like there's almost this mini revival, and that carries us through to 1998. I'm just gonna note it here though, because if you can't remember Armageddon, you may be thinking of the movie Deep Impact, because as well, Galen Hurd seems to have a penchant for releasing big disaster concept movies that have another film using the exact same concept come out in the same year.
Okay, so let's dive into the history of this, because this is much weirder than you would think. All right, technically the origins for what would become Armageddon date back to 1992 with a writer, Jonathan Hensley. Now, he's probably best known for being the writer and director on Punisher 2004. I'm sure he's thrilled that that's the credit I went with. But the point being here that, you know, he at this point in time was apparently interested in the figure of Red Adair, who is an oil well firefighter of some note. Particularly,
to wind it back, proof that real life is always going to be crazier than anything you make up. Like, imagine if the script for this movie had an oil firefighter named Red Adair. We would all roll our eyes and say, come on.
Well, Red Adair, yeah, and Red Adair was actually, his life was turned into a feature film starring John Wayne once upon a time, but that's for a story for another time in this instance. The key point was, Hensley was interested in this kind of figure. He didn't want to make a film specifically about him, but that kind of archetype figure, and he ended up coming up with this idea of imagining, well, what if a Red Adair type figure ended up having to go into space basically to drill and detonate an asteroid and would end up having to sacrifice himself in the grand scheme of things in order to save the planet. Basic idea. He was mulling it over for a few years, and, you know, he's an up-and-coming writer. You know, maybe he'll have his shot to go along with that someday. Now, then we cut over to a few years later, basically around 1996, producer Galen Hurd apparently had a film called Premonition in development, which was about a man who was obsessed about the idea of an asteroid that would come down and hit the Earth.
Which is the same concept as the film Knowing with Nicolas Cage.
Yes. Now, apparently, Touchstone Pictures, who she was with at that point in time, which was a division of Disney that technically no longer exists, they were sort of liked the general idea, but weren't really sure if it was big enough in this instance. Now, it just so happens that Galen Hurd, who we should note here, was a producer behind such films as Terminator and Terminator 2, and a bucket load of other films, including Ang Lee's The Hulk and The Incredible Hulk, amongst others. She was basically in a relationship with a person by the name of Jonathan Hensley in this instance. And Hensley basically saw this as an opportunity. It's like, well, if you're looking for an idea.
Yeah, slides it under her pillow, leaves it on the breakfast nook in the morning. It's like, oh, I left that script laying around, honey. You didn't read it, did you?
Well, apparently it's not quite as bad as that. But basically he had this idea. It's like, well, I've been mulling this over for a while. What if I go in and pitch it to the studio? Because I'm really on this. And she was on board with when she heard what it was, and it was like, okay, we're going to get you in touch with the studio head at this point, which would end up being Joe Roth, who was running things at the time. Now, Hensley at this point basically decides he needs something to go in with him, somebody to back him up to make this a more attractive package. And the reason he's thinking about this is,
and you can see why, though, because, I mean, also through the 90s, I think the danger is, like, there's sort of a string of underperforming space movies. I'm thinking Lost in Space is generally seen as a disappointment. The Star Trek films of the 90s didn't. They certainly didn't make a huge splash or as much as they intended. There are movies that gear more towards sort of like the hard sci-fi, things like Contact. Event Horizon kind of sneaks under the radar. It's kind of a cult movie now, but it certainly wasn't huge. There's almost this sense that, well, we can't just make a sci-fi movie about outer space. So, the trick is, you dumb it down a little bit. And that leads us to the perfect one-two punch for the pitch. one Michael Bay.
Yeah. Now, Hensley had worked with him twice before. The first was he did about 10 drafts of the screenplay for the film The Rock, aka the best thing Michael Bay ever did. The problem was Hensley never ended up getting credit on that because the WGA arbitration process basically said, no, you can't do it. The studio apparently did try to give him executive producer credit, and then the WGA came down hard on it, saying, no, you can't, for whatever reason. Moving on from that, he did also work on another Jerry Bruckheimer film, which was called Con Air, where, yes, he did finally get credit for that one, both which were made for Touchstone Pictures. So Hensley had his own working relationship with the studio as well. And while by all accounts, Hensley wasn't necessarily the biggest Michael Bay fan ever, because by all accounts, he's a very moody and shouty director, to put it mildly. He effectively decided, it's like, well, Bay's big, he's got a track record, I know I can work with him, let's try and get this in. So yeah, he pitched the film to Bay. Bay was really on board with it, and Bay started trying, basically coming up with pre-visualization and things like that that he could use to convince the studio of, like, this is what we're gunning for. They pitch it to Joe Roth, and Roth is excited about it. He's absolutely in love with it. And in fact, he comes up with the title of a movie, which is Armageddon. Small problem, though. Armageddon was trademarked by Warner Brothers at this point. So Roth's basic approach was, well, we can trade some stuff with them. So basically, they had titles they had trademarked that they swapped with Warner Brothers in order to get the title of Armageddon. And what were those titles? Well, none other than Father's Day, which, yes, became that god-awful Billy Crystal Robin Williams film from director Ivan Reitman. And yes, on top of that, there was also conspiracy theory, the underrated Richard Donner film as well. So
all I remember about that one is that Mel Gibson isn't really dead in the end, and he tries to bite Patrick Stewart's nose off.
Yeah, but putting that aside, so they get their title in this instance and that, and they start putting things together. Except a little thing happens on the way to getting this movie involved here. As we noted, Gail Ann Hurd and Jonathan Hensley are in a relationship. And in fact, they're engaged. In fact, they will soon be married. And my understanding is they still are married and happily so to this day. So kudos to them. But with that having been said, the studio basically decides they want another producer on here to help make sure that the budget doesn't balloon into excess.
And because if you look at Bay's prior movies, namely Bad Boys and The Rock, like, they are successful films, they are action-driven films, but I don't think you can really consider either of them to be an effects-driven film, whereas what we end up getting with Armageddon very much feels like on a different magnitude of scale. And so, even though Bay has a familiarity with working with sort of like that feature-length music video, sort of high-gloss cinema at this point, taking a young up-and-coming director and then suddenly being like, all right, now you have to put all these VFX shots together, you can see why there was a little bit of hesitation there.
Now, from Hensley's perspective on this, he kind of saw this as a dig and slight at Gail Ann Hurd, mostly because what he figures was that the studio didn't trust her because he was in a relationship with her to keep an eye on the budget and keep making tough script notes, which he insists she more than likely would have been capable of. And with fairness here, when you consider Gail Ann Hurd's track record of successes here, I kind of understand, like, yeah, she was more than capable of doing that job, but for whatever reason, the studio was insistent on bringing a different producer in to keep an eye on things and work with Gail Ann Hurd. And in this instance, who did they happen to bring in this instance, Andrew?
I'm trying to follow up with the notes because these are really involved.
Okay.
That Jerry Bruckheimer, Mr. Lightning Tree?
Yes. So Jerry Bruckheimer, whose partner Don Simpson had died around this time and who had formerly been set up at Paramount, had been working with Touchstone for a few years, including that little film Con Air, which was a mega success for them. Now, Bruckheimer was known for being fairly, tight with making sure keeping things on budget there. But he's also known as a heavily creatively involved producer. And once he steps in line, there is a bit of tension over, well, who's doing what job as the producer on this film? As Hensley apparently put it, basically him and Herd more or less, the decision was is that they didn't want this to turn into a fight that looked like they were allowing their personal relationship to interfere with their business practice in this instance. So Herd effectively starts to quietly step away from the day-to-day operation of this film. She's still credited, she still did work on the film, but basically from this point forward, for better or worse, Jerry Bruckheimer's now in the driver's seat alongside Michael Bay, whom he had worked with on Bad Boys previous to this. So, with all that being said here, what ends up happening is the script continues to be punched out by Hensley and Michael Bay, to the point where Michael Bay is starting to demand that he gets story by credit, and apparently him and Hensley get into a massive argument with it, with Bay eventually actually backing down and saying, fine, I won't take story credit on this.
Yeah. Script problem solved. Make a note of that for a few minutes from now. So we have producer issues. We have script credit issues. Well, I guess after resolving that, we need to figure out who's going to be in this movie.
Yeah.
And this leads to a very interesting wrinkle that feels more like following sports journalism. Because my understanding is they have Bruce Willis in mind. But Bruce Willis, at this point, has a small problem. Because apparently he is involved with a film that I gather has never been released and never been reworked into something else called Broadway Brawler. And writing's on the wall, the project isn't going so well. Bruce Willis wants out, but I guess they end up working out a deal where Touchstone basically agrees to buy the rights to the film to bury it in exchange for Willis appearing in three movies for Touchstone, Armageddon being one of them.
Yeah, so basically, yeah, they front the money to Willis to buy the film. So Willis technically owns it, but this is all with the understanding that, yes, he is going to star in Armageddon for sure, and then two to-be-decided films in the future. Which, as you noted, Andrew, what were the two films that he would go on to star in for Touchstone after this?
Those end up being the film that largely is considered an underperformer, M. Night Shyamalan's Unbreakable, but more importantly, M. Night Shyamalan's mega success, The Sixth Sense.
Yeah.
So, yeah, probably turned out better than Broadway Brawler would have. But yeah, so there's the finagling there that gets them there. And eventually the cast sort of starts coming together as the pieces fall into place. But again, as I have said before, you know, it says a lot about a film when there are problems with the script. Evidently, they did catch some of them in production, or maybe it's a case of too many cooks, because the script continues to be tinkered with, even after Hensley and Bay suss it out together. So eventually, a whole host of people end up working on different pieces of the film. For instance, Robert Towne ends up writing what later becomes the mutiny scenes. Scott Rosenberg gave the supporting cast most of their dialogue. Ann Biederman came in to rewrite Liv Tyler's dialogue scenes. Tony Gilroy ended up penning a new opening for when they first detect the asteroid. J.J. Abrams of, modern infamy, gets brought in to work on the dialogue. Imagine that. And Paul Attanasio and Shane Salerno come on as well for additional rewrites. So I'm pretty sure that the final script is credited to Hensley, Abrams, and I think they're the only two that get credited?
Well, it's a bit more complicated. So the story goes to Hensley and apparently somebody by the name of Robert Roy Poole, who worked on the film Breakout. I don't know when he got involved. Nothing I could come up with points to that. But also on top of it, there's Hensley, J.J. Abrams, Tony Gilroy, and Shane Salerno end up getting actual Writers Guild credit on the film. But again, that apparently this was the working procedure on most Jerry Bruckheimer, Don Simpson production projects in years past, where, yeah, you basically just rotate writers on and off in order to work on specific scenes and situations and dialogue. The consistency of the script be damned. And we'll get
there,
folks.
And I mean, that's just another clear point of distinction between a film like Armageddon and, sort of auteur cinema, something like Ingmar Bergman, right? The idea that some view film as a personal passion project, a creative exercise, whereas this very much shows all the signs of being a studio-driven picture rather than one clear vision. That being said, you can very easily see why this film's production budget ends up ballooning to close to $140 million, which in 1998 is a non-insubstantial amount of money. The film ends up being released, and not to bury the lead here, but Deep Impact comes out the same year, which nerds all around the planet love to point out is a lot more scientifically accurate. This film, Armageddon, comes out. It gets generally unfavorable reviews. And none of that matters because it ends up grossing $550 million worldwide, becomes the highest grossing film of the year, and eventually finds its way into the Criterion Collection. So I know that we're going to get into all the things you can riff on and goof on in this movie, but I think at the outset, it is worth noting that, yeah, this is not art cinema. This is not even upper or lowercase cinema. This is Hollywood filmmaking sort of at its zenith. And for all you can say about the film itself, they unquestionably succeeded and pulled off what they were going for.
Now, here's my thing about this. I won't disagree with what you're saying, except for two teeny tiny points.
Okay.
Yes, I will say this. Number one, I agree that many blockbusters out there are made for crass commercial purposes. That's the whole point. That doesn't mean you can't make a good movie while you're doing it, number one.
Agreed.
Yeah, there are many, many. And in fact, let's look at some of the films that birthed the blockbuster. Jaws is a great movie. Star Wars is a great movie. And then you even have half-decent ones, which are still generally entertaining. The summer of 1998 also gave us Lethal Weapon 4. Not a good movie, but at least I would say it's more cohesively put together. And yes, also had 11 screenwriters work on it. Let's put...
And brought Jet Li to America.
There we go. But let's look at it this way. I agree with you that Armageddon is also the sign of American blockbuster filmmaking at its zenith, in the sense that this is the most cynical, calculated, misbegotten piece of freaking garbage that American cinema ever made popular. I am not burying the lead on this one, folks. I hate this movie. I
will say, Dave, in this film's defense, another film in the same vein, Pearl Harbor. I would rather watch Armageddon than Pearl Harbor any day of the week, because even though there's a lot of similarities between the two, not just Ben Affleck
or Michael Bay,
this one at least focuses on the everyman, and thus it can do away with some of the jingoism. I mean, it's still a bunch of American roughnecks saving the planet for everybody, but I would take this over John Voight giving inspirational speeches as FDR, or Alec Baldwin with absolute sincerity. Anyone not brave enough to take this mission, don't step forward. You know, it's just, I don't want to ruin your fun. There is something that does feel very cynical about this film. I think largely because of how calculated every beat of this film feels.
Well, not only how every calculated this beat of this film feels, but let's also look at it this way. Here's my thing about Michael Bay. He is unquestionably an auteur. He is unquestionably able to generate beautiful looking images. I also deeply, deeply, deeply suspect he hates mankind with a passion. Like, this man just...
Maybe just women.
Well, I honestly don't think he has a love for anyone. He has contempt. He will take your money gladly. He has no problem with that. He actually loves all the toys. He doesn't care a damn for soldiers. That's an amazing aircraft.
Oh, he loves soldiers. Remember in Transformers how there's, like, the human unit that, like, walks up behind Optimus Prime? Like, yeah, don't worry, Optimus. If you can't get the job done, we've got your back.
See, but that's my thing. It's like, it feels like he includes those things as the token gesture. I never buy into the thing. And that's my thing about Michael Bay, and my problem, as we'll get into with this film, about his common man, working stiff individuals, is this feels like a film made by individuals who has absolute contempt for the audience that he wants to see show up for his audience. And here's the sad part, and I will say about this. When it comes to this film, his contempt paid off. I mean, anybody who can openly spit in the eye of its audience in this way and still get them to fork over money, I guess is doing something right. Doesn't mean I hate it any less, though, as we'll get into.
Well, I guess the one, maybe something that sets Armageddon apart from a lot of other Bay films, at least previous to this, is that this is also a PG film.
Yep.
And so I think, though, there's this weird tension where it does feel like there's something kind of reactionary at the heart of this film, but you also have to think that this is a film whose nominal protagonist is a self-avowed roughneck, an older man who has difficulty letting go and not being possessive of his daughter, but presumably, by making it PG, you're aiming this as, if not a family affair, you're trying to get teenagers in. And I mean, that also explains why, anecdotally, apparently the love story angle was added during production, or emphasized during production, after another high-profile and mega-successful film from 1907, little film called Titanic. It felt like the producers looked at that and they're like, see, that's what made it work. People wanted a love story. Yeah. I guess all that to say, though, is we've talked a lot about the background of this film, and it seems a lot went into the fact that it's a pretty straightforward story. And just in case there was any doubt, we get one of the greatest things you will ever see in the film, a contextual opening narration, where we are told, we're basically given a space eye view of the asteroid that made the dinosaurs go extinct hitting the Earth. And then you get that that wonderful hook dropped of, it has happened before. It will happen again. The only question is when.
Yeah, which brings us to a group of astronauts in space working on a space station or satellite there at that point. I'm not really sure they ever clearly established what that is. But point is, astronauts in space, they're working on stuff. The one guy seems a little nervous, but it's like everybody's kind of joking. They're getting along.
And to let us know exactly what kind of territory we're in, you know, this isn't gravity here. This isn't even Ad Astra. This is a whole bunch of people standing over computers, talking about vitals. And then Dan Truman, played by Billy Bob Thornton, he's called in and demonstrates his expertise by telling all the astronauts they gotta calm down a little bit.
Exactly. And that seems to be working for reasons. When all of a sudden, a piece of rock flies out of nowhere and ends up smacking off and sending the one guy flying. In this point, it enters the atmosphere as this is going. Which leads us to a rather peculiar montage as the NASA scientists are trying to figure out what just happened. First, leading us to old man standing, looking out of his telescope, getting into an argument with his wife, playing by, returning for the show for the third time, Grace Zabriskie here.
Ooh. One day we will see a movie where Grace Zabriskie actually gets a role.
Yeah, but in this instance, she gets to basically play the yelling, screaming wife for her husband to come in while he is basically misogynistically telling her off and everything else. It's like, bring me the dang phone and other stuff in this instance. Because
it's funny because they hate each other.
Yeah.
Yeah. But he gets a view of this asteroid. NASA apparently doesn't. They're scrambling to figure out what's going on. Meanwhile, Eddie Griffin, remember him, is biking through New York. Gets into an argument with a Hawaiian gentleman selling Godzilla figurines before a meteor shower hits downtown Manhattan, including, is it one of the WTC buildings that gets knocked over?
I can't remember offhand, but I would like to point out that that Godzilla reference was deliberate because guess what else came out in the summer of 1997 or 1998.
Real clever there. And don't worry, the dog Little Richard survives, and then we get the immortal moment of Eddie Griffin surrounded by calamity looking at the sky and yelling, somebody call 911. Back at NASA, though, they talk to Armchair Observatory Man, who tells them that he ID'd what's going on. It's not the Soviets. It's not experimental weaponry. It's an asteroid.
Yes.
And then we get, like, the joke for dads where he wants it named after Dottie, his wife, because it's a merciless thing that'll kill anything it touches.
Yeah.
So now Dan and the gang, they know what they're up against. There's an asteroid the size of Texas, and it's going to hit the Earth in 18 days. Which leads to maybe one of the film's secret weapons, General Kinsey, played here by returning and beloved face on the show, one Keith David.
Yep, and I will say this as well. In addition to Keith David, there is one other weapon I like that this film has, and that's Jason Isaacs in this instance. Yes, the man who one day could have been Bond, but at least got to lead the USS Discovery during the first season of Star Trek and Discovery. Who's playing, what is his character's name? Ronald Quincy.
Yes. Smartest man in the world.
Yeah.
Because Kinsey is explaining that the president's team wants to fire every nuke that they have at the asteroid and knock it off its course. To which Quincy, like, maybe we'll come back to the scene, but he explains that that is not going to be impactful enough for various reasons of physics. What he proposes instead is that if you actually drill into the asteroid and then detonate a bomb from within, that will actually blow the thing apart and cause the remaining fragments to miss Earth completely. Now, I do like how he points out, you know, that appeal to his own authority, where Kinsey's talking about what the president's advisors say, and he's like, I had a couple classes with the president's advisor. I wouldn't trust a man with a C+ in astrophysics. And it's like, oh, snap, you burnt. And I'm like, imagine somebody saying that to you in real life, and your response being anything other than punching them in the head.
Well, that may be the case. Still, it's the closest thing to a good scene this movie has, and it all goes downhill from here, because now we move to an oil well.
The plan is, we're gonna hire the world's best deep core driller. Which brings us to one Harold Harry Stamper.
Yeah, which I have other names for him as well that I cannot repeat on air in this instance, but yes.
You repeat them a lot through the notes.
Yep, the big thing here in this instance is, yes, we meet Harry, who is just one of the guys. He's Bruce Willis, and he's a regular guy, even though...
It's me, Bruno. I run an oil company. I'm flinging golf balls at hippies.
Yeah, and in this instance, he's looking for AJ, played by Ben Affleck.
I wish Affleck did his Boston voice in this movie.
Like I said, I mean, the one thing I want to see is I do want to listen to the commentary track apparently he did for the Criterion Collection, which is just Affleck riffing the movie for the entire 2.5 hour runtime of it. But
I would pay money to listen to that.
Yeah.
It says, yo, Avery, I'm in love with your daughter.
Okay.
How do you like them apples? Okay. Yeah.
But
we're
yes.
Getting ahead of ourselves.
Yeah.
But yeah, we're sort of introduced to the ensemble, which includes Harry as the head man, and his team of lovable oddballs. We got Chick, his second in command, played by Will Patton. We've got Rockhound, played by the inimitable Steve Buscemi, whose basic character is things that were funnier in 1998. We have making a pretty strong screen presence here. Michael Clark Duncan, one of his first significant roles as Bear. We have, a blink and you'll miss him, Owen Wilson as Oscar the Geologist. And yes, we have AJ, who's currently got Harry's backup because somebody authorized one of the drills to turn back on. And Harry ordered that it was shut down.
Yeah, and when Harry walks in, it turns out that AJ, you know, is very apologetic and concerned because it turns out there's somebody else in the room that he doesn't want Harry to see. And this is going to turn out to be Grace, played by Liv Tyler. And it turns out that, yes, Grace is Harry's daughter.
Now, how do we find that out, Dave? Do you remember the brilliant dialogue?
I honestly don't because I was too busy raging at what's about to happen, but you fill us in.
He pulls the sheets down, and then we see Liv Tyler, who, 1998, you know, bankable film actress. Probably didn't hurt that her dad came with on the soundtrack. She just like, hello, Harry. He says, I told you before, I want you to call me Dad.
Oh, God, right, right.
But yes, we discover AJ and Grace are in love, and Harry, he just, not only is he mad at AJ for being a cowboy on this one, but he's especially angry because he didn't raise his daughter to fall in love with a roughneck.
Now, let's put it this way. You might sit there and think, okay, Harry might have a reasonable thing where he walks away upset and will have a conversation with his daughter later about, I don't think he's a good match for you. I don't trust him for whatever reason here. Or maybe he'll surprise us all and turn around and say, it's like, I'm not happy about it, but I respect you and it's your decision and I trust you to make the right call in what goes on in your life. Or you could do what this movie actually does, which is Harry goes and gets a shotgun and starts chasing AJ around, literally firing bullets on an oil refinery. Now,
yeah,
let's...
Oh, don't forget while the Japanese investors are there, too. You know, and it leads to that sort of, like, it's going for, like, sort of zany screwball bit of light comedy. But it's also hard to watch that. And, like, not just set aside, there are many criminal charges that can be laid, but, like,
and should
this
be?
Simply just... makes no sense. This would not happen. I try not to be a stickler in this kind of movie. That's just like, come on. But this all culminates with AJ getting shot in the leg, and they strike oil, though. They hit a real gusher, but Harry isn't satisfied. He tells AJ that somebody could have died, and you don't want to have that on your conscience. He gets fired. Just in time for NASA to show up and tell Harry that they have big important mission, they need to debrief him right away.
Yes, but Harry's insistent that his daughter comes with him because they...
Well, it also quickly reverts from, like, Harry, you weren't there for me when I was a child. If I'm gonna talk to the government, my daughter comes with me. We do everything together. It's like, which is it?
Yeah, and he also tells the crew to go away, you know, to get off the rig and take some leave time in this instance, because sure, why not?
Yeah. So he is quickly apprised of the situation by Truman and co. And they basically tell him, this is all classified. We're not going to tell the general public this. But there's an asteroid that's going to kill everyone. We need you to fly into space with our team of astronauts. Bunch of real by-the-book guys. And you're going to have to drill into it and detonate a nuclear warhead. And Harry agrees, but he can't do it with these schlubs. He has to work with the guys he knows.
Well, and this is where, okay, let me start talking about why I hate this movie so far. So first of all, the plan is to send trained astronauts into space to operate this equipment in order to do this, which...
with seems like a good plan.
Yes, Harry insists, you expect me to train these guys in a couple weeks to know how to operate all this equipment here and know how to
You're making them too nasal. It's more like, you expect me to... Okay, now that sounds like Triple H.
Yeah, the point of the matter here is that, yes, in this case, I mean, Harry talks down a bunch of guys, you know, and gals who have presumably gone through extensive heavy training here to get to where they are. And then he starts telling off all the NASA crew, but you misbuilt my rig. You stole it from me. And now it's not even going to work properly. Come on.
Yeah, so Harry is somehow worried about being a roughneck, but he has a patent for, like, some kind of mobile drilling unit.
Yeah, like, none of this makes sense. And he's just a jerk. Like, the problem with Harry as well is his default is... you know, they want him to be the cool sort of cynical guy. He just comes off as a petty know-it-all jerk at every point, even though, as we've already clearly seen, he's not that clever. His first instinct is to try and kill a man rather than respect his daughter's choices in life. And now he's telling off a bunch of highly trained individuals, you're not good enough. You know what you need to do? You need to take my crew into space. We can learn all this stuff in a weekend. I mean, it's like
Connery in League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, where you see what they're trying to do, but it just comes off as, like, crass and unlikable.
Oh, yeah.
But it's also, I mean, I think... this film sort of saw the failures of, like, hard sci-fi and sort of internalized that lesson as, well, it's not that those films were too cerebral for a general audience, but they need a more relatable character. So how about an oil man who goes around talking about how nerds and Poindexters don't know the first thing about working in the real world? Which is fine, but it gets tiresome after 2.5 hours.
Well, I mean, here's the thing. It's a difference between a relatable protagonist. Say, I don't know, Walter Matthau in The Taking of Penhelm 123, in this instance. Well, that's a relatable character in a film. Peter Parker is a relatable character in film. These guys are the macho jerks who probably were, you know, sitting there giving guys swirlies in high school, and somehow now we're supposed to find them cool. And that fits entirely with Michael Bay's worldview. Let's not forget the immortal words he gave Sean Connery in The Rock. Losers whine about their best, winners go home, and in expletive deleted, the prom queen.
I don't remember that line, but I mean, case in point, like Owen Wilson's Oscar is coded as one of the smart ones, but he's still, like, all we know about him is that he is a cowboy. He likes horse riding. Same thing with Steve Buscemi, who's the other smart one. His whole thing is that he's a crazy wild man who loves strippers and gambling and stuff like
that.
So it's like, even when you're stratifying, like, the nerdy ones are still wild and crazy out there, guys.
Yes, and then we get to some of our other individuals. There's Max, another one of these crew, who's the sort of...
the fat one?
Well, I wasn't going to describe it like that.
That's basically what he's codified.
I know.
He doesn't really get a character.
I know. And that frustrates the hell out of me with this movie. It's like, just insulting. Like, yeah, but he is very much in the sort of Bluto sort of character archetype of this group. And yeah, and then you got Bear, who they, for whatever reason, he's on a motorcycle getting chased by a helicopter and an army.
Like several helicopters.
Yeah, it's like, what am I supposed to be believing happened during the scene? Like, what is going on here? But this...
Does NASA commandeer all these resources? Did they set up a federal dragnet for a man on a motorcycle?
Apparently.
I do like Duncan's ad lib. Come get Papa Bear!
Yeah, it's just open.
And I mean, even though he died far too soon, and I mean, he wasn't always in great films, but Michael Clark Duncan definitely has a screen presence.
Oh, yeah.
And when he is on, he is impossible to dislike.
Yeah, he is one of the very few bright spots in this film. But this leads to the scene where Willis is explaining everything to the guys and what that's going to be required here. And yes,
now, David, here's where I'm going to stop you, because there's one guy that we didn't mention.
Oh, yes.
And there's one guy who I'm not even sure if the film gives a name to. The guy with the beard.
Oh, yeah, him. Whatever.
He has maybe two lines of dialogue. He is one of the core members that Willis needs on his team. And spoiler alert, he dies along with Oscar the moment that they land on the asteroid. This guy does nothing. I don't know who plays him. I don't know what his character name is. He's just there, and then he's not.
Yeah, he is cannon fodder. And then there's also AJ, that chick has to talk Harry into reaching out to, which leads to a god-awful scene of Bruce Willis coming in talking about what, you know, it's like, I wouldn't trust you with any job on Earth, in this instance.
Yeah. Well, also, somehow, because we know from the beginning that everything that happens has to happen within 18 days. Somehow AJ started his own successful drilling company.
I don't know if he actually did or didn't. Like, it's really unclear what's really happening there. The point
is, it says AJ Frost Drilling Company on the billboard, and he's got a Shelby Cobra parked in front.
So fair.
Seems to be doing pretty good on a quick turnaround. But yeah, then we get the very Pearl Harbor-esque, President of the United States has asked us to save the world. Anybody want to say no? And then we get the right stuff riff montage of the guys in training. We see them not enjoying their physicals. See them all giving wacky responses to the psychologist played by Udo Kier of all people.
Yep.
And then we basically find out that these guys, they're not the right stuff. But the question is, are they going to be able to survive in deep space?
But now, let's be clear about a couple things about this. Number one, They are, like, if this one, we're supposed to find this a lovable, likable montage of these characters. No, they are all obnoxious jerks, insufferable individuals. Max's interview with the psychologist is just infuriatingly annoying as he starts breaking out in song and other stuff. Meanwhile, as they're getting their physical here as well, we have the chick start noting here, it's like, oh, I'm just an oil driller. That's all. And she goes, oh yeah, so am I, because she's going to give him a proctology exam there. And he has the wacky excuses like, oh, this is,
it's that 1998 thing of nothing is funnier than a guy getting something put in his butt.
Yeah. It's just, oh God, I hate this movie. And let's not forget, they also have a list of demands that they want. In this instance.
Now, that is a kind of amusing scene. Yes. Now, granted, it's not necessarily laugh-out-loud funny. Apparently, that was also an ad-lib read. But yeah, the guys have their demands. They all want their parking tickets squared away. They want their families looked after. And then the offhand, oh yeah, can you guys tell us who really killed Kennedy?
Yeah, which has to be a nod back to The Rock in terms of what's on the microfilm at the end of that movie. But on top of which here, then it's the line that was in all the trailers, and the guys don't ever want to pay taxes again, ever. Yeah, so, okay, fine. Now, at this point, they're introduced to the colonel who's going to be overseeing the mission. That's
not just any colonel, Willie Sharp, who is the greatest thing about this movie.
Played by William Fichtner, who is too good for this stuff. But he basically comes in and rightfully points out that these guys are questionable at best. And yeah, we're sort of bypassing the whole psychological exam thing and taking that seriously in order just to expedite getting them into space. So yeah, all fair questions in this instance that have been brought up here. But sure enough, when these guys, their training isn't going so good, you know, Willis insists, it's like, you got to give these guys 10 hours off. Well, it's like, well, we don't, Dan's point is like, we don't have that kind of time. What do you know? It's like, and Willis, and again, I know what they're trying to do. It's like, I'm telling you, these guys need the time off. You want them to go up there and not know what they're fighting for? Well, it's like, okay, first of all, are you seriously telling me that not having 10 hours off in the face of extinction?
Yeah. And it's like, this is 18 days.
Yes.
Yeah. It's like, they're going to go up there and be like, oh man, I can't remember what I was doing 2 weeks ago. What is this, how you say, Earth?
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's so dumb, but it's mostly here so that the guys can go blow off steam and do one more dumb thing before they leave.
And we can get one more Aerosmith song on the soundtrack.
Okay, but now let's go through some of these rapid fire quickly, because we got Rockhound, who basically borrows $10,000 from a bookie or from a loan shark in order to go spend it out on gambling and with, yes, strippers in this instance. And I believe Max is with him for that one as well. We have...
And the bearded guy. Though we also get a line that I have never forgotten when he gets into it with somebody in the club, where it's, oh yeah, well, here's some cash. Go buy yourself a neck.
Yeah. But then there's also, at this point, we cut to Chick. And here's the thing. Will Patton, up to this point, has been the likable right-hand man to Bruce Willis. As insufferable as everybody else is, Will Patton's, been pretty decent. And then they drop a very peculiar thing, because he's just standing outside this woman's house where there's a boy out front, and just asks, is your mother home? And then she comes out and tells her, it's like, oh, it's just a salesman, go inside. And then she drops the following words. You can't be here, Chick. You know, the court says you can't be here. To which my immediate thought is, wait, hold on a second.
No, she says it confuses him. I think the implication that you're supposed to come away with is that they're divorced, he's been estranged from his son for quite some time. I know that this film does not earn any good faith interpretation, but I don't think we're supposed to take away that a court order has separated them because God knows what Chick did to this woman.
It's one of those things where it's like, when you drop it like that, it's like, I have some questions about Chick's past. And I mean, particularly when he says, I'm sorry about everything, but here, take this rocket ship.
I think it's more messy divorce and they haven't seen each other for quite some time. So it's more, what are you doing here? It's been however many years.
That's probably the case, but I am not willing to give this movie the benefit
of the doubt. I'm willing to give it only because Will Patton, of all people, actually gives, like, a tenderness to this scene
Fair.
That really seems at odds with the rest of the film.
Well, that's because Will Patton's a good actor and knows what he's doing, but...
Well, like, that's the thing. This is a film that is loud, large, and ugly, but there are a bunch of little moments where the character actors get to show their commitment to their character, as thin as they are. But most of that's kind of swept by the wayside, though, because really the important thing is Ben Affleck and Liv Tyler meeting cute, the eroticism of animal crackers, and Ben Affleck's Australian voice.
Oh my god, this scene.
And I believe the soundtrack sampled the dialogue for that scene. But it's just, yeah, it's, now, the gazelle is gonna go up in the north. That's your bosom.
Oh, God.
And it's just like, the setup should not lead to a moment of romantic coupling. But then, you know, this sort of culminates with the very night before AJ and Grace in the airplane hangar as Harry watches on. I don't know what he thought he was going to walk into, but AJ asks Grace to marry him, and she says
now,
yes.
Before he asks her to marry him, we can't overlook with the gazelle animal cracker scene, the immortal words of Liv Tyler's Grace in this moment. AJ, do you think there's other people on Earth doing this very thing right now? No! No! Nobody is playing with animal crackers at this
moment.
I would
hope not, you know? It's, I thought we were going to get an even more groan-worthy line, like, AJ, are you going to play with it or are you going to eat it? Or something like that, but that would be too clever by half. 10 different screenwriters and they couldn't have hit the obvious one. Yeah, but all of that culminates with the day of the big launch, the president giving a solemn speech, which, you know, it's fine. We got everybody walking. They board the ship. They talk about the plan and everything, and they blast off into space to save mankind. And immediately upon approaching the asteroid, something goes catastrophically wrong and one of the shuttles crashes.
Yeah. Now, we should also note at this point that Chick's wife suddenly tells her son, that's your dad up there.
Right. Because during the launch, the kid who's watching it on TV is, Mom, that salesman's on TV. Which is a cute moment if it wasn't so, like, Hallmark moment.
Well, the problem with... Here's the other thing about this movie. Michael Bay, as you most people probably are aware, got his start directing music videos and commercials. And oh my god, does this film indicate that? Because so many montages of what's happening around the globe, I swear if they ended with use Discover card, I would not have been surprised at any moment. They all look like ads.
Well, yeah, because we have the Taj Mahal, we have everybody in Paris huddled around one television.
Yeah.
You know, it's just... far and wide, the whole world is watching.
Yeah, it's just, it's like, yes, we've been brought together through Bell telephones. Like, no, it's just, stop, no movie, God. But yes, we're in space. They first land, before they even land on the rock, they stop at the space station for refueling, the Russian space station.
Oh, right.
Because, yes, we are then...
Yes, everyone's favorite Russian actor, Peter Stormare.
Who, as I understand, is not actually Russian, so it's, yeah, but yeah, he is doing full-on cartoon Russian in this point, individual sequence here.
Yeah, he is Yakov Smirnoff in Zero Gravity. In home country, I am hero. Don't touch photo of uncle.
Yeah.
And it's just, man.
Yeah, but the point is, though, is that during the refueling, something goes wrong. I don't know whether AJ's to blame or not. The film isn't really clear. It's like he gets orders, from the Russian in this individual.
Lev,
yes, thank you. Who points out...
Because what else would his name be?
Yeah, does all this, and then lo and behold, suddenly it's chaos, there's explosions, people are having to rush back to the ship. AJ can't get on the first ship, though, with the other, so he ends up having to get on the other ship. They all think he's dead at this point, with, you know, Lev with him now on the shuttle as well. But let's not forget, In one of the most inexplicable parts of this movie, for some reason, Grace is being allowed to hang around Mission Control in this instance. And this does lead to the immortal words when she thinks AJ's dead of, you know, Dan turning around, it's like, you shouldn't be here. And her saying, I have nowhere else to go. To which my immediate response is, no, well, the follow-up line should have been is Dan saying, no, literally, you shouldn't be here. Why are you here? I thought I told security to make sure that nobody breaches this area. Get the hell out.
See, if I were Dan, I'd just be like, what, you don't have an apartment?
Yeah.
Get this woman a hotel voucher, quick.
Yeah.
The boys are working. But I mean, and like literally everybody who is not on the asteroid is in the control room for the remainder of the film. Yeah, I completely forgot that they blow up the space station by mistake. Lev comes along for the ride, and then the second shuttle crashes. So a bunch of the faceless professionals end up dead, as do Oscar, unnamed beard man, and for a good long while it seems that all is lost.
Yes.
Meanwhile, the other shuttle, which has, let's see if I can remember, which has Max, Rockhound, Harry, Chick, Colonel Willie Sharp, and the lady, they land a little bit rough, but they seem to successfully touch down on the asteroid.
Yes, and the that is Jennifer Watts, played by Jessica Steen, in this instance, the co-pilot of the ship, who's just been, you know, looking down condescendingly on everyone, because she is quite right. They are all the, you know, obnoxious jerks for the most part. But putting that aside, yes, they land, but this leads to Rockhound then basically tearing all the NASA crew a new one, because apparently he's so smart that he understands that something's gone wrong in this instance and isn't going to work.
Well, they landed in the wrong spot, so the composition is not conducive to drilling. They don't really have any other options. I guess they shouldn't have waited so long before taking off, but
yeah.
We get the refrain through the second half of the film, which is, we gotta get to 800 feet.
Yes. So, okay, they start trying to drill, and it seems to be taking them forever to get going with this. Meanwhile, AJ and them discover that they have, you know, don't worry, we actually have a, basically a rover that they can take out.
Well, first off, we learn that AJ is alive, and conveniently him, Lev, and Bear all seem to regain consciousness at the exact same time.
Yes, but this leads to probably one of the many, many questions I have about this film as well. When they discover the rover and decide to say, yep, we can get out of here, we can drive, and we can try and meet up with the gang. For some reason, the rover is outfitted with machine guns.
Yep.
Why not? Why?
Bullets fire in a zero gravity environment, right?
Who are you going to shoot? Is this NASA's immediate response? It's like, first contact. If you meet an alien, shoot it. I mean,
Dave,
wouldn't be surprised.
Space Force is a real thing. Do not undersell American militarization of everything.
But the point of it, I also point this out because, A, they use the guns to blow their way out of the shuttle. I'm sure there was an easier way of doing that. But putting aside, this is going to be important later when Bruce Willis and Harry start asking about, why does the Colonel have a gun in the ship? Here, it's like, really? You're asking that now? You didn't ask it when there's the giant machine gun turreted devices down below? I mean,
yeah,
like
it's because like from here on, we sort of get the parallel edits where AJ and crew are trying to find the other ship. Unbeknownst to them, Harry and his crew are trying to drill, and it is not going so well. And eventually things come to a head, and it looks like they're not going to make the deadline.
Yes, and at this point, the Colonel contacts there and is basically given the order to go with Plan B, which was the military plan come up with in this instance by seemingly Kimsey in this point, which is basically, we're just going to detonate the thermonuclear warhead now rather than wait for the drill and take us all with us here. Which,
if that was the plan, why wouldn't they just fire more nukes into orbit? I guess it's like the last contingency where if we're approaching 0 hour, you know, the point at which, if it's not blown up by now, it will hit the Earth. If we miss this deadline, then we have to blow it up, sacrifice our own lives in the hope that it might do something.
Yeah, and the point here is this leads to a standoff between Bruce Willis's Harry and Chick and the colonel in this instance with them, and saying, we're gonna give us more time, we're gonna drill it. This leads to a whole big fisticuff and fight there, when I can't even remember what BS line Harry uses to convince the colonel to finally give up on the plan and to go ahead and then disconnect the bomb so it can't be remote.
Yeah, I'm actually trying to look up quotes now, because I know that William Fichtner gets a couple choice lines here, and it's he is delivering all of his dialogue with the utmost sincerity. Like, there is nothing at all wink at the camera or ironic about it. And there is something really, really endearing about it. I love William Fichtner a lot. I think he is, he very much is one of the that guy actors that that really need to be better known. I mean, this is not the most representative film that he's been in, but I'm just seeing if I can find it. Given how extensive the IMDb for this movie is, I'd be surprised if it's not. Oh yeah, it's because they're arguing, and then Chick keeps counting down how much longer is on the bomb. They're in the final minute, and then it's, I can't do it alone, Colonel. I need your help. Do you swear on your daughter's life, on my family's, that you can hit that mark? I will make 800 feet. I swear to God I will. Handshake. Then let's turn this bomb off.
Yeah, it's awful. It's awful. And knowing that this is the sequence Robert Town wrote as well.
Yeah. It's just like everyone believes in Harry. On the basis of what, though? Because everybody just says, all the time I've known Harry Stamper, he's never missed a target. He's never missed a drill foot distance. It's like, how many other jobs have you been on where, like, whoever you're contracting to is like, by the way, Stamper, we need you to hit a certain depth by this hour of night. Like, it seems like a weird brag and a skill that most people would not need to brag about.
See, the thing is, what you're missing is that this line was ADR'd. The original point was Harry's never missed somebody he's shot at in his entire life. Oh. And this is the case, because apparently,
well, except for AJ, he missed several times before getting him in the leg with a ricochet.
That is true. So yeah, but that's why they ADR'd it.
Yeah, hem and a ha, they dismantle the bomb, or they turn it off, and then back on the ground, Truman commits treason. Right?
Yeah.
We're not mistaken here, where he orders his techs to jam the uplink signal so the army can't reactivate the bomb.
Yeah.
It's just a bit of a stall, and all of a sudden, though, Kimsey and his crew get wise, and we do get the surefire sign that you're watching a PG-rated film, because Billy Bob Thornton drops the film's only F-bomb, which is kind of a decent scene, the tension there, even though it's completely undercut by, oh, Dan, you little trickster, you're deliberately interfering with the president's direct order, and in so doing, you may also cause the extinction of humanity. They get that reactivated, we get the dismantle the bomb sequence, and in pure Hollywood trope form, they do it with a second left on the timer. Yeah. But back to drilling! Only to encounter a problem, there's a pressure burst, and their drilling unit with Max inside gets blown off into orbit. All is lost.
Well, before that even happens, we have to note about what happens with Rockhound. Where basically,
oh, yeah,
he discovers...
I just remembered the best line of dialogue in the movie.
Okay, yeah, let's walk you through this, because for whatever reason, Rockhound's been, you would say he's been getting more erratic, but the truth of the matter is, as played by Steve Buscemi with this script, how could you tell? So they have to give him the most absurd thing to do, which is apparently he found a device with the rotating machine gun on it that's controlled by body movement, hooks himself into it because apparently nobody's paying attention, and then just starts firing off a bunch of rounds around everybody in this instance, which eventually, when they get him down, leads to the Colonel, William Fichtner, God bless him. He tries so hard to sell this line. My God. Space dementia.
No further clarification, no further dialogue, no context. My God. Space dementia.
Now, I was...
And, like, yeah. It's just, and I agree with you, Dave, like, I can see a version where the character gets more brooding as the mission goes on, and, like, there's even dialogue of, like, look, if we're all gonna die up here, I'm gonna die on my own terms, but you're right, it's Steve Buscemi's own. Look, fellas, we're all gonna die up here, so, I'm gonna have some fun while I do it. Hey, what's everyone mad at me for?
Yeah.
No, I don't tip.
Oh god.
Yeah, it's just, it also feels like there's a beat missing because they tackle him to the ground and then we get some more like ancillary dialogue from Rockhand, and then next time we see him he is duct taped to one of the chairs in the shuttle. Yeah, so he goes loco and he ends up damaging the remote detonator control.
Well,
but yeah. The more pressing issue, though, is that of all the intergalactic caves that you could have driven the armadillo unit into, AJ and crew arrive just in the nick of time. There's literally minutes left before they hit 0 hour. They have one more shot, one more drill, one more transmission to hit that depth.
Which, okay, let me be clear about this as well, because the film has set up this idea of AJ being reckless and a cowboy, like, you know, Harry is the model of stability and a sure hand in all this instance, but the whole thing is that the first time, you know, he turns back on that pipe which explodes because apparently it was under high pressure and was dangerous to do, which went to get him fired. He then tries to do the same thing in the NASA diving tank because he goes past the safety parameter so the machine automatically shuts down, which gets him chewed out by Harry, which leads to the payoff of this, where AJ is insistent that he's right and that Harry's got to trust him at least this one time, if ever. And Harry does, and it happens to be right. To which case, this isn't AJ learning a lesson just so much as it is confirming that AJ was probably will just carry on with the questionable behavior he was doing in the first place here.
Well, on a more formal level, like, this is basically the climax of the film, arguably, or at least this sort of stretch. And it's just not that interesting. Because it dawned on me that this is a film where 2 hours and 20 minutes, and it's a 2.5 hour long film, so much of that is characters standing around saying, Harry's the best driller. No one does it like Harry. Harry can do no wrong if you put a drill in his hands. And all we ever see him do is just stand around and tell his guys, come on, guys, we gotta drill deeper. And here, like, it's reflected, like, this scene largely consists of dialogue between Harry standing outside on the asteroid and AJ inside the drilling unit, then going back and forth, gradually yelling numbers that get closer to 800, and then AJ saying, I can do this. Okay, kid, make the call. And then he yells 800. And it's supposed to be this big triumph, but there's nothing really visually interesting about this entire proceeding.
Well, on top of which, it basically reveals that, yes, Bruce Willis's character's role in this movie is the heroic middle manager? Why is he on this mission? He's like...
Exactly. Foreman the movie.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so now they just need to, just load the bomb in the hole and, bada bing, bada boom, remote detonation. There's a problem. The remote detonation parameters have been damaged. You can only blow up the bomb manually, so somebody is going to have to stay behind and trigger it. And again, you know, it's sort of that beat that's fairly predictable. It concludes with them drawing straws, but the tension is kind of undercut because, you know, there's another version of this movie where everyone discovers what they have to live for. They need to get back home. Here it's the opposite, where literally everyone volunteers to be the one to do it.
Yeah, and instead in this instance, yes, AJ is the one who draws the short straw, so of course he's going to stick around.
But he also seems crushed by it.
He is.
Because literally 30 seconds before, everyone's like, Harry's like, I'll stay and do it. And Chick's like, no, I've always stood beside you. I'm not letting you do this. And AJ's like, no, I'll do it. I want to be a hero. And I think Lev is the only one who's like, I'm not interested in this. But then AJ draws the short straw and we all gotta die sometime, right? But yes, and then Harry agrees to walk him down, and as soon as they're about to get out of the elevator, he detaches AJ's breathing hose, so AJ can't go outside. He locks him in the elevator and says, you got another job now. You got to take care of Grace. Sends him back up. Well, Harry walks over to the bomb. Thankfully, he grabbed the one portable radio, whatever, so he can have one last tearful goodbye with Grace, who, it does give us that really cool shot of her in front of all those static televisions, but he basically apologizes for all the times he's let her down, and he has to break a promise again because he's not coming home, but it's okay because she's always going to be with him, and the best parts of himself, that was always her within him as well.
Sure, why not? Anyways, so while this is going on, they take off from the asteroid, start going, but it turns out, you know, whoops, Harry ends up getting knocked down. He has to reach up to grab the remote in order to press it. So it's right down to the last possible second. And sure enough, yeah, he detonates it. And then the two...
Yeah, we see the hand on the throttle, like, debating whether to turn around. It's like, unless you can land this thing and find the switch in 30 seconds. I'm sorry, Colonel Willie Sharp, but you're not gonna fix this. But then we also get that, no, Harry's gonna do it. He doesn't know how to fail. And it's like, this guy runs a moderately successful oil rig. Maybe not pretend that he's Superman. But sure enough, the asteroid is safely blown into two pieces that will both miss the Earth. And we also get that thrown in line of dialogue, and most of the debris will be vaporized when it reaches Earth's atmosphere. And I'm like, I noticed the word most there seems to do a lot of heavy lifting.
Yeah.
It's like, look, everyone, America is saved. Meanwhile, in Italy, it's just everything's on fire.
Yeah.
But sure enough, they end up landing. They get the hero's welcome on the tarmac. And the survivors are greeted. Let's see, what do we have? We get the culmination of the chick storyline, where in slow motion, kid running out with an American flag t-shirt comes to greet his dad, and that's kind of a sweet moment. Then otherwise, nobody really does anything important, because by this point, AJ and Grace, they get to reunite. They have a big kiss, and then we get the final bon mot from Colonel Willie Sharp, who interrupts the kiss with a absolutely rigid salute. Colonel Willie Sharp, United States Air Force, requesting permission to shake the hand of the daughter of the bravest man that I've ever met.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. And it's only followed up by, because we forgot to mention that basically Harry, before, while locking AJ away, hands over his NASA patch to AJ and says, give it to Dan, which, yes, he does pass over because Dan always wanted to go into space, but he just wasn't able to. He just gets to run the place, which...
Well, he has a brace on his foot, so it's implied that something happened and he wasn't able to actually be one of the flyboys.
Yeah.
And then he says, Harry wanted me to give this to you. He did, huh?
Yeah.
And then there's a kiss, and the film literally goes to the credits.
Oh my...
Soundtracked by the immortal Don't Want to Miss a Thing by Aerosmith.
While, and we should note here, as the credits play out, we're given the handheld camera footage, which looks like it's shot on 16mm or Super 8, which, by the way, I'm pretty sure in 1998 wasn't a thing that people were even doing at that point. I'm pretty sure video was the standard. But yes, it's...
Oh yeah, the wedding.
Yeah, because it's...
We see the dead people's portraits smiling at them with their cold, vacant eyes.
Yep.
I really like, though, at the end, where it freezes on the photo, how next to Ben Affleck, Denzel Washington materializes, and then it turns to color. Different concluding wedding scene.
Somehow I was less infuriated by that movie than this one while watching it. Maybe that one's just more confounding as you're watching it compared to this, but...
But I mean, that's Armageddon, and I think to unite the beginning and second half of this episode, it's that it's a film that gets unnecessarily complicated for such a simple premise and ultimately a very simple execution of it. There's a lot of bells and whistles. There's, you know, a lot of sort of B plots and parallel stories that don't really add anything significant to the film, but it's also giant asteroid is going to crush the Earth. Do we really need Robert Towne doing dialogue? You know, it seems like a film that has all the hallmarks of an unsuccessful production. Costs overran, way too many people got involved, everyone was arguing over who got credit for what. It is 2.5 hours, a lot of it can probably be cut down. It's generic, it's both anti-intellectual and trying to be smarter than it actually is. It should not work. And yet, by most metrics that you look at, undeniably, this film succeeded.
Well, I mean, look, I will say, yeah, it was a box office success. I will never be able to deny that as much as I wish I could. But the point of the matter is that the end of the day, as a film that I'm responding to, I just find this to be, like a lot of Michael Bay films, it's just a loathsome bit of cinema. His entire ethos, his entire worldview that he brings to his films is something I just find garish and off-putting and unpleasant. It is the celebration of absolutely everything I detest in this world of might makes right, ultra bravado, whoever's the bigger bully wins kind of mentality, dressed up in these sort of schmaltzy, phony, half-hearted efforts at sentimentality that you can clearly tell Michael Bay has no interest in whatsoever. And confoundingly, yeah, I mean, the anti-intellectual streak there, like, this is like, it'd be one thing if this was a film where Vanessa and a crew and the oil drillers come to respect each other's skill sets and come together and realize we need each other in this instance. That would be one thing. This is a film that at every conceivable point is all about, you know, those guys, the elitists who run NASA and the government and that? Yeah, don't trust them. They're a bunch of petty, yeah, no-nonsense
bookworms. Those dweebs
bookworms
can't lace our work boots.
Yeah, it's just, oh God, I hate. And then you get
I see what you're saying. I think the problem is because Michael Bay does have that very consistent sort of outlook across a lot of his films. That is very superficial. It does seem kind of reactionary. It's very slick and very surface level. I guess the question is, it's sort of a no-win situation, because if he doesn't genuinely believe in this sort of worldview, then it's cynical. Then it's just, okay, you're clearly just doing it because you think it sells or whatever. But on the other hand, if you sincerely believe in this worldview, I guess that's also kind of weird.
Well, the thing for me about Michael Bay is he just goes where the money goes. And honestly, here's the thing I will say about Michael Bay. It would be so much better, and it is so much better, when he makes films where he doesn't pretend that he cares about other people. And that's the thing about it. It's like, I still find it reprehensible, but it's honest at least. Like, I may not like Bad Boys 2. I really don't. But it's an honest movie from Michael Bay from start to finish in terms of what his worldview is. Unquestionably there. Pain and Gain is unquestionably an honest view about what his world is. And yes, The Rock, again, that one line is the distillation of everything that Michael Bay believes in one movie. And it's unquestionably the best movie that he's ever made. I still don't like his attitudes. I still don't like his worldview. But at least it's like, well, you're upfront about what you are. And that movie is at least semi-intelligent enough to create a framework where I'm willing to at least follow along and enjoy it. This thing is just extraordinarily unpleasant and unlikable. And I just, like, I get that some people take sort of an ironic joy in it. I just can't. I really cannot bring myself to enjoy this movie at all.
Well, a few points worth noting. I mean, I think a lot of why I found myself smiling at points in this film was because of nostalgia.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember seeing this film when it came out in theaters. There are certain lines and the cadence of those lines that I remember clear as a bell. What I would put to you is that Michael Bay actually ends up being a more interesting filmmaker when he doesn't have to work within a PG framework, simply because then, as you said, he can be more honest about sort of his interests and his target audience. And as we nodded to at the beginning, like, who is the assumed ideal viewer of this film? Because it does seem to be, for an older and decidedly working class sort of, also a man. And I just don't know if that necessarily meshes with the PG framework. Transformers is another case where it's like, you know, you're kind of restrained because at the end of the day, you also need to make a movie that kids can get in to see. And that's not to say that the same commercial impulse or like the toyetification or multimedia branding as you see in Transformers happens here. But I guess there's also maybe there's more of a drive towards like sort of optimism and universalism that just rings fairly hollow here. And Bay can only really construct sort of that universalist, come on, guys, we're one planet working together, in visual terms that he understands. And as you pointed out, it looks like a credit card commercial. I guess, I don't know. Like, this film is a very interesting distillation of what Hollywood blockbusters sort of became when it hit a saturation point. And I feel like after 9/11, it changes a bit, where, you know, you have to, it's not enough to be universalist, you have to be pro-American, right? That all of a sudden, budgets grow bigger, it's almost assumed and accepted that your film is going to cost more than $200 million. It's just, it's weird. I would like to see what this film would have been if they were allowed to give it an R rating, because otherwise we're seeing a lot of people look up and then a wide shot of an asteroid or a meteorite crushing them from above. Or you see a close cut to a character screaming and then you see a suit flying off into orbit, right? Like, it feels very sterile in a weird sense. I don't know. I think it's important, to be honest, when you're sitting down with this film, to understand the kind of film that it is. And I think more than any other genre you can slot this film into, really, this film is best understood as a blockbuster. That's what its genre is. And that's why it hits all the beats. Where, well, we need to have some bit of a love story. We need to have some nods towards characters learning lessons. We need to have some loss and some hardship. We need to have some union and coming together right before the climax. Like, we need to have those beats because that's what blockbusters do. And in the end, it doesn't really matter to the parties involved, whether it sticks the landing or does anything meaningful with all of those nods. What matters is that they're in it, because those are the things you need to have to make what we understand a blockbuster film to have. And so again, sure, this film was probably ironically put in the Criterion Collection. Bruce Willis said that he would never work with Bay again. Ben Affleck, you know, riffs on this film and sort of has a tongue-in-cheek retrospective on it. Even Michael Bay himself has said this film didn't turn out the way he wanted to, but it was a valuable learning experience for working with bigger scale productions and working with VFX. So thank you, Armageddon, for spawning the films that followed. It's like nobody seems to like this film. Nobody involved with it seems satisfied with this film. And yet, in spite of all of that, this film succeeded and this film has endured.
And that's the thing that just frustrates me, is why? Like, I mean, Michael Bay's whole career just astounds me in many ways. I mean, all right, you know what? I will end on a positive note. I will say this for this movie. Unlike the first Transformers sequel, the hero of this film doesn't sort of condone the notions of genocide while gunning down a victim there in the form of a children's movie. So that works for me, all right?
Oh, yeah. So. And you were wondering why this film succeeds, to which I say, because that's Hollywood, baby. Not everybody wants that Barton Fink feeling. And now I'm thinking about another film I enjoyed more. This week I also watched Belladonna of Sadness and Angel's Egg, and those are probably the two most diametrically opposite films I can think of for Armageddon. That being said, though, look at that, we're about to hit 0 hour ourselves. So we should probably wind it up before Dottie winds it up for us and turn to our patent-pending bumper segment, Hits and Pits, where we celebrate and condemn the little things. So Dave, this may actually be a challenge for you. What is your first hit for Michael Bay's Armageddon?
Okay, so if I'm gonna have to give a hit in this instance, Jason Isaacs. I like his presence. I like his thing. And again, while his character gets unfairly picked on at various points for being, you know, smart, the big thing here is that, yeah, he's charming and he isn't offensively obnoxious in this movie. So I am going to give him credit for that. So in this instance, yes, I will give him a hit here. What about you, Andrew? What do you have?
I would probably give it to Billy Bob Thornton in his role as Dan Truman. Because Truman really fades into the background for long stretches of the movie, and it's not to say it's a big role or even a great performance, but he does feel like a real character, or at least there are contours to him in a film where most of the other characters are, okay, you're a trope that has a name. And, like, I do like the scene with Truman and Harry talking about Dan's regrets of not being able to go up there. And, like, I think it's just, it's a nicely understated sequence in a film that really doesn't have any subtlety whatsoever. You know, say what you will about the likability of the other characters or the realism of them, Billy Bob Thornton actually, the way he plays the role of Truman, it works as a nice connective tissue throughout the film. No, it's that human element when suddenly it's mostly VFX. Dave, what about you? Can you come up with a second hit?
I am very happy that Udo Kier got a paycheck out of this. I'm assuming he was paid more for this than the entire time he was working on things like My Own Private Idaho or Rob Zombie's Halloween. So that makes me happy. I'm always happy to see
Udo happy.
And
worth noting, Steve Buscemi said in later years when asked about why he did this film, he responds with, because I wanted a bigger house.
Yeah, and that does not surprise me. That is really the only reason I think anybody worked on this film. What about you, Andrew? Do you have anything for a second hit here?
Yes, William Fichtner, Colonel Willie Sharp. It's okay. You know, we've talked about Clancy Brown and his beloved quote about how you'll be in a bad film for a lot of money or a good film for no money, but you won't be in a bad film for no money. I think there's sort of an ethos there for character actors where it's like, if you're taking the check, you gotta show up for work. And it's one thing to give, like, maybe not your best performance. William Fichtner in this movie, you can see he, even though he must know how ludicrous the script and the dialogue is, he does not care. He is playing this character as written. He is doing his best to give it life, to give it a dramatic import. He is trying way harder than I think this film even warrants. But that's why I love William Fichtner so much. You know, it's the most stock character, but he is absolutely sincere in everything he does throughout this film. Plus, he's got that spiky 90s buzz cut. So, God bless William Fichtner, and I'm sure you got a good paycheck. And that's why you could then do other stuff like Drive Angry, where you literally are the only good thing about that film. Yeah! That's probably the reasonable hit that I have. Now the fun part. Dave, what's your first pit for Michael Bay's Armageddon?
While I could just wave my hand and say pretty much everything else, the big thing, let's highlight one moment where I see what you're trying to do, movie. I know you want this to be the cute thing where you find all your characters likable and charming that we're supposed to invest in AJ and Grace's relationship. But no, the leaving on a jet plane sing-along is not charming, it's not fun, and I like the song, okay? You had that going for you. It just comes off as cloying and obnoxious and phony as can be in this instance. Like, I just do not believe it or tolerate it or like it at all. Particularly given that, yeah, you're all facing doom right now. Is this really, you know, the attitude or mood that everybody's going to be in going into space?
You thumb your nose at the devil, okay? It's called optimism. It is corny.
Yeah.
I'll give you that. Though probably not as bad as, I believe it was a tie-in to this film, Chantal Kreviazuk's piano ballad cover. Yeah. It feels like we're trying to manufacture a special scene that everyone's gonna love years from now. Which, I mean, your mileage may vary. So leaving on a jet plane, that's your pit. All the things you could pick. Let's see. Trying to think about specifics. I mean, Disappearing Man still throws me for a loop and always has as long as I remember seeing the film. You know what? We'll do your second one because I have one on the tip of my tongue. A specific... Oh, wait. Now I remember. There's way too much Aerosmith on the soundtrack. Listen to our Be Cool episode and I'll give you all my thoughts on Aerosmith. But especially the fact that, like, this is a film that springs for the song Come Together to be featured in it, but not the Beatles version, the Aerosmith one. And I think there is something absolutely on the nose, though, about the fact that, like, I feel like if you're the kind of person who thinks that Aerosmith is an exemplary, like, this is what real rock and roll is, like, if you think of Aerosmith as like a standard bearer for rock and roll, then you're probably going to be fine with everything that this film presents you with. I don't know how to explain it, but that feels right to me. I am not a fan of Aerosmith. Nothing pulls me out of a film I'm trying to be immersed in than hearing Steven Tyler yelping on the soundtrack. They play Sweet Emotion during a training montage, and I'm like, that's the opposite of high energy. And, I mean, this film also is responsible for Don't Want to Miss a Thing, so, boo for that. Aerosmith is the reason Armageddon is a lousy film. Aerosmith and only Aerosmith.
See, here's my thing. My actual second pit also deals with Aerosmith, but for different reasons than yours.
Okay.
Because here's the thing. Okay, I can live with the use of Aerosmith on the soundtrack. I don't hate them altogether. I don't think they've been terribly good in, say, 30-odd years, but I can tolerate them for the most part. Here's the problem I have here. We have a scene in this movie where Ben Affleck is playing with animal crackers, going up and down Liv Tyler's midsection towards parts which are clearly are indicating that he some sort of act of lovemaking, we shall see in this instance, or onto her breast while they're kissing in this. And you have Steven Tyler singing Don't Want to Miss a Thing over top of this.
Yeah.
I don't care what you paid for the music in this instance here. There is nothing weirder than having, you know, a sequence of a woman making out with her boyfriend, possibly leading to other things, while her father in real life is singing on the soundtrack about basically, I don't want to miss a thing. Like, it's...
Not to mention, while soon after, her diegetic father is also watching the couple when they don't know he is there.
Yeah.
So that's a double-layer dad voyeurism scene on an auditory and visual level. I take it back, Dave. This film is brilliant.
Ah, that wasn't
you
where I was...
could not try to make a more densely structured metafictive reference. Michael Bay truly is a genius. You've convinced me.
I will say,
let's see Bela Tarr do that. Who wants to sit through the Turin horse? Nothing blows up.
All I'm saying is that sometimes it does sometimes take a true auteur to fail this spectacularly. What about you? What's your second pit in this instance?
You know what? I revoke my previous pit because if Aerosmith was not on the soundtrack, we wouldn't have the greatest scene of all cinema.
Damn it.
So, yeah, you know, greatest movie ever, hands down. No, I think Ben Affleck is pretty unremarkable. It's not that it's a bad performance, but there's nothing to it, and there's not enough room for him to do anything with the character beyond be the young hotshot, and that's not necessarily sympathetic in itself. Also, I mean, I get that the film is trying to be like, AJ is too much like Harry, and that's why he doesn't want Grace marrying a roughneck. And it's made clear at the end where it's like, I've always thought of you as a son in that. But what it means is that you're not getting a contrast of opposites. As you pointed out with the ensemble, the problem is that all the guys are basically more or less the same. And it ends up flattening, I think, like, the emotional impact. It also ends up flattening the idea that there's any learning or reconciliation that any of the characters display throughout the film. We all come away realizing that, well, NASA's big idea worked, and Harry, he truly was the best at drilling. And that's just not terribly interesting.
No, it isn't. So, yeah, that's Armageddon, folks. If you want to stream it, it's on Disney Plus. I don't know why. I would recommend not.
Yeah, you can find a horizontally flipped copy on Dailymotion, but be warned because it plays an advert like every 4 minutes.
Yeah, so on that note, I guess we should figure out where we're going next from here, because...
Yeah, tell the audience, because they don't want to miss the thing. Hoyo!
Yeah, so having watched...
Yes, tell us where we're hurtling towards, much like an asteroid. Okay.
Yeah. So I figured after this, we very excessively long, 2.5 hour long movie, we would move on to something that is much shorter and more, tightly controlled and maybe not requiring as much explanation. Oh, wait, no, screw that. We're actually doing the exact opposite. We're following Will Patton to 1 year prior for Kevin Costner's The Postman.
The Postman, a film I know only by its legend. And apparently Tom Petty plays himself, which is the second time we've encountered that. Actually, third time. Because Running Man, Mick Fleetwood may or may not be Mick Fleetwood.
Yeah.
Be cool, Steven Tyler is Steven Tyler.
Yeah.
And now we have Tom Petty in a Kevin Costner movie about the apocalypse and the importance of routine mail delivery to provide blood to the beating heart of American culture or something. It's going to be weird.
Yeah, and it's nearly 3 hours long, so God.
Oh my God. Okay, well... Maybe I'll just keep a copy of Cormac McCarthy's The Road nearby, and when it gets dull, I'll just transpose one onto the other. Fun times. And before that episode drops, if you don't want to miss a thing, and yes, I'm going to do that every opportunity I can in the last few minutes, where can people get in touch with you, Dave?
You can find me at 24 Panels. If you're looking to mount a defense for this movie, you're wasting your breath. Just don't, okay? Anyways, where can they find you, Andrew, if they want to do that and maybe find somebody more receptive to it?
Well, if you don't want to miss a thing, you can message me on Twitter at FilmStripper, or you can email the show at filmstripspodcast@gmail.com. Brenda in Glendale. I do like your handle of Brendale@gmail. To answer your question, the answer is I Don't Want to Miss a Thing by Aerosmith. And as always, if you don't want to miss a thing, you can rate and review us on iTunes or whatever podcatcher you use. 5-star reviews help move us up the featured chart and get new eyes and ears onto our show. And it's an important place where you can leave us a little bit of feedback. Rate and review us. Let us know what's working, what isn't. Have you missed a thing? Do you want to miss a thing? Let us know. Because all Dave and I have ever wanted to do is bring you a show that you want to listen to. And we certainly don't want to miss a thing.
And on that note, Andrew, do you have any parting words you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Yes, David, I do. I don't want to close my eyes. Just kidding. Yeah. Remember, everyone, adventure may scare you, but monotony will kill you.
Kiss me and smile for me. Okay, bye.
Would you say you don't want to miss a thing?